Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, in honor of Black History Month, we're exploring a piece of Ulster County's past you may not know, the early days of baseball and the Black players who shaped the game. Coming up, Ulster County Clerk Taylor Brook joins us to share the story. Frost Valley is rolling out a new way for families to share the camp experience. And in the spirit of Guthrie and Seeger, singer, songwriter, and playwright Richard Holler is bringing songs of protest, love, and lived experience to the stage this weekend. Plus, girls just want to have vintage couture. Some of Cyndi Lauper's personal wardrobe is making a surprise stop in Sullivan County. We'll tell you how a Manhattan closet cleanout turned into a local benefit sale coming up after this hour's news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Federal Aviation Administration has reversed course and lifted its temporary closure of airspace around El Paso, Texas. The FAA closed the airspace overnight with no warning. The agency cited security reasons. It was supposed to stay closed for 10 days. It's unclear why the El Paso airspace closure has now been lifted. Stocks opened higher this morning as the Labor Department reported stronger than expected job growth last month. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average jumped about 140 points in early trading.
Hiring picked up steam in January after anemic gains in November and December. U.S. employers added 130,000 jobs last month, with much of that growth coming in healthcare and construction. Bars and restaurants added about 28,000 jobs in January, while factories added 5,000. The positive news was tempered somewhat by an annual update showing job growth last year was much weaker than first reported. On average, employers added only about 15,000 jobs a month in 2025. But with many baby boomers retiring and fewer immigrants coming into the country, the unemployment rate has remained low. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
NPR has learned that a grand jury in Washington, D.C. has rejected an effort by federal prosecutors to indict several Democratic lawmakers. It's not immediately clear on what federal charges. But last year, six Democrats released a video urging members of the U.S. military to refuse illegal orders. Republicans, including Speaker Mike Johnson, think the video was illegal.
I think that anytime you're obstructing law enforcement and getting in the way of these sensitive operations, it's a very serious thing and it probably is a crime.
President Trump has said that the Democratic lawmakers' actions in releasing the video were seditious. Trump later walked back his comment that it should be punished by death. Two former assistant U.S. attorneys in Minnesota are now defending two independent Black journalists. The journalists were charged in connection with a demonstration at a church last month in St. Paul. Minnesota Public Radio's Matt Sepik has more.
Don Lemon, formerly of CNN, and Minnesota journalist Georgia Fort are accused, along with seven activists, of conspiring to violate the civil rights of worshipers. The Justice Department charged them under a law that it historically used against the Ku Klux Klan. Joe Thompson, who's on Lemon's defense team, previously led the prosecution of social service program fraud in Minnesota. He and several others quit after the Justice Department pressured prosecutors to investigate the widow of Renee Macklin Good after an ICE agent killed Good in January. Former fraud prosecutor Matt Ebert entered private practice last year. He's part of Fort's defense team. For NPR News, I'm Matt Sepik in Minneapolis.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are now up about 80 points. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. U.S. Attorney General Pam Bondi will testify before the House Judiciary Committee this morning. She is expected to be questioned about the huge release of documents about late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Some lawmakers say some names of men allegedly involved with Epstein are still being redacted by the agency. Authorities in southern Arizona detained a person for questioning yesterday in the disappearance of Nancy Guthrie, the mother of Today Show host Savannah Guthrie. There are unconfirmed reports that person has now been released. Separately, the FBI has released images and videos of a masked, unidentified person outside Nancy Guthrie's home. That person appears to be armed. This is day three of a teacher's strike in San Francisco's Unified School District. Classes are canceled again today for nearly 50,000 students. From member station KQED, Aya Ali Ahmad reports.
Thousands of educators marched through the heart of the city, demanding the district fully cover family health care in one of the nation's most expensive regions. The district has offered to cover 80% of those premiums, but union leader Natalie Hurritzi says that's not enough.
We walk the line and tell us 100%! Get the raise we deserve to stay in our city.
The district says it currently faces a more than $100 million deficit. For NPR News, I'm Aya Ali Ahmad in San Francisco.
And you're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Capital One, offering their premium travel card, Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. As Black History Month continues, Ulster County is reflecting on the stories and contributions of the region's Black residents, past and present. One piece of that history is tied to an unexpected place, the baseball diamond. Tomorrow, Ulster County Clerk's Office, together with the Ulster County Restorative Justice and Community Empowerment Center, are hosting a Lunch and Learn event exploring the early history of baseball in Ulster County and the remarkable role Black players and communities played in the 19th century. Joining us now to talk about the event and the connections between baseball, local history, and community is Ulster County Clerk Taylor Brook, who also happens to play vintage baseball. Taylor, thanks for joining us.
Of course, Tim. Good morning.
Tell us a little bit more about the inspiration behind this Lunch and Learn event focused on early baseball and Black history in Ulster County.
Yeah, you know, this is going to be the first time that we're talking publicly about a really fascinating new discovery that we made. So in playing vintage baseball, we play by 1864 rules, and we do a lot of research in that era of baseball. And what we found this winter was evidence of an integrated game being played on the Rondeau in Kingston in 1867, about 6 months prior to what is traditionally known as the first integrated game that was playing down in Philadelphia. And so according to the official MLB historian, John Thorne, who we spoke to about and has written about this, this is really the first recorded integrated game played in America. And it's really fascinating that it happened right here in Ulster County, and interesting that it didn't get a ton of fanfare. So we're doing some more research to try to confirm, but it almost seems like this was a fairly routine occurrence in Ulster County, that Black teams and white teams were playing against each other, potentially right up until the Major League Baseball bans Black players from playing. But it's a very interesting bit of history and really goes to show how sports and culture collide, and really how sports in a lot of ways brought us all together. And it isn't until those rules change, like after the Reconstruction era, that Black players are banned, and then we get into the Jim Crow era, and Jackie Robinson comes years later. But before that, Black players and white players, we have evidence we're playing right alongside each other right here in Kingston.
Do you have an idea of why this history wasn't more widely shared or known?
There's not a lot of people doing research in this specific era. It's a pretty niche topic. Again, the official MLB John Thorne historian, he did write an article about this, but no, we don't know why it wasn't picked up by kind of larger baseball historians and talked about more. Part of the reason is we don't know much about it. There's just like one small account in a newspaper that this happened. So what we've been doing is researching some of the, they name all the players who played. So we've been doing research into the players. And again, that's very fascinating. A number of the players are Civil War veterans on the Black team. So there's a lot of threads that we're trying to follow right now. We're wondering, you know, if Black players and white players who had potentially played baseball during the Civil War, we know that various generals were putting in orders for new baseballs and equipment while they were deployed to kind of keep up morale in some of the troops. So when they all come back from the war, they're familiar with the game, and they're playing it right here. But, you know, it's like a lot of other Black history or history of any traditionally marginalized groups. A lot of this just gets buried. It doesn't get picked up in some of the bigger canonical historical texts from that era and shortly after. So that's part of the fun about history. When you start digging, you learn that things were a lot more diverse, and there's a lot more stories that haven't been told yet out there.
February, of course, is Black History Month. What do you think modern audiences can learn from what you described as like a niche part of the history of baseball in Ulster County, particularly in terms of social history and community building?
I think stories like this help to solidify the idea of baseball as America's pastime, and that really it was baseball itself in this early era is a melting pot. You have, you know, various teams, various different ethnicities, famously like the Cuban Giants come to play in Kingston. There's a very famous team shortly after this era in the early 1900s, the Kingston Colonials, who attract major league teams, a lot of Negro League teams. Satchel Paige pitches here. And, you know, for Black Americans, hearing stories like this should give them pride. Like, we tend to think of American history as having a straight trajectory of folks having not a lot of rights, and then slowly but surely they get more and more, when really it's more of a roller coaster. Directly after the Civil War, Black Americans have a lot of rights that are then stripped away after white Americans are a little uncomfortable with the amount of rights that the Civil War allowed them. And so I think it helps illustrate how complicated history is, how much nuance there really is. But I'm hopeful that it gives people pride in their communities and know that really everyone should be welcome at all times, but especially like on sports fields. This is one of the beautiful things about sports. One of the reasons we play vintage baseball is to remind folks that sports are more than recreation. It's one of the few places in society where the playing ground is quite literally leveled. You're all playing by the same rules. And almost every other aspect of society then and now, that is not necessarily true.
You play vintage baseball yourself, as we mentioned. I want to ask you a little bit more about that, but I also want to ask you about your partnership in the clerk's office with the Ulster County Restorative Justice and Community Empowerment Center to host this event. Talk a little bit about why that's important, how that came together.
Yeah, we've been working with them for years now. They do a really wonderful job at the Restorative Justice Center of presenting educational material and having community events. They like to open up the space. They always do a lot around Black History Month and Sojourner Truth. So we have an exhibit up in the space now, and every year we usually do at least one, but this year we have, I think, four lunch and learns planned with them. So in any way that we can support their mission, that's something that the clerk's office is passionate about, and part of the reason that I ran for this office to begin with is the history that is included in the records that we store. The stories that are in those records need to come out, and they provide a really wonderful location for us to do that and attract a group of folks that come that are generally not history people. You know, if you put on a history lecture, you get often the same group of people. So when we branch out and collaborate with other organizations, you get to tell history to folks that may not have ever even considered these things. So we love what they're doing at the Restorative Justice Center.
How does it feel to combine your role as county clerk with your passion for vintage baseball in an event like this?
Well, we've got the records. This was part of the reason we were able to find these kind of stories. A lot of times they happen randomly. This one sort of happened randomly. But we have a wonderful newspaper collection and photograph collection that are all public records, too. If anyone else is interested to do research in any topic, we're always happy to help out. If we don't have it, we can generally point in the direction of who may have it. So anytime we can utilize the records, we try to do that, and it's especially fun when you have a personal interest in it, in something like this. But again, it's not just me. Dan Torres, another captain on the vintage baseball team, will be there. Our county archivist, John Palmer, and our county historian, Eddie Moran, will all be there, and all have various areas of expertise, and I'm sure there'll be some interesting discussions that arise from that event.
You know, I realize that we were talking about vintage baseball, and folks may not understand what that means. Can you describe a little bit about what the rules are for vintage baseball compared with modern baseball for folks?
Absolutely. You know, it's still recognizable as baseball. You still have bats and balls and whatnot. No gloves. That's probably the biggest change.
Ouch.
And yeah, you get used to it. The balls are a little bit softer, but it's more of a small ball game. So a lot of the fields, a lot of these teams were playing in open fields with no fences. So you're not generally hitting home runs. You're stealing a lot of bases. Probably the biggest difference when you're watching the game, you can catch the ball on one bounce and it's still an out. You don't have to catch it on the fly, so that makes the no gloves rule a little bit easier. But it changes the game pretty significantly. The games tend to be much more fast-paced and often higher scoring. So it can be a lot of fun for fans. All the games that we put on are totally free, and we try to do interpretation, like between innings. We'll explain what's going on, what the rule differences are, and it's just a fun time. We're going into our fifth year this year, and we've added two more teams. The popularity of it has just kind of exploded. We have something like 40 to 50 men and women interested in playing. So we're it's been successful. We have a blast doing it.
Let's remind folks about the event tomorrow. It's either in person or via Zoom. And who's going to be participating on the panel?
It'll be John Palmer, our county archivist, Dan Torres, captain of the Kingston Guards vintage baseball team, Eddie Moran, the Ulster County historian, and myself.
And folks can get more information where and give them the details of the time for it.
It's going to be at noon tomorrow. If they go on the Ulster County government website, there's an events page and calendar. They can find info about it there. And again, it's going to be on Zoom too, so I'm hopeful that it'll be recorded. And if you miss the one tomorrow, Dan and I are doing sort of a longer version of this at the Maritime Museum on March 18th at 7 p.m., where we'll present a little bit more research, because again, this is all kind of new. We're still doing the research. So if you miss it tomorrow at noon, check out the Maritime Museum schedule for March, and we'll be there as well.
Before we go, what's it been like exploring this topic through this lens for you, especially, you know, in the context of Black history and the county's Black community in the 19th century?
You know, it's just been really eye-opening how much equality existed for such a short period of time. The Reconstruction era is just one of the most interesting eras of history for me personally, and it's really a shame to see what happens right after that in the Jim Crow era, where you start getting laws that are passed that strip away these rights that a lot of our folks here locally just fought for in the Civil War. And you have whole Black communities that crop up in just a few years that are then sort of destroyed or moved. And it's a painful history to research, but finding positive stories and sort of uplifting stories, part of the reason that Black History Month is still important and will always be important, because these stories didn't get the limelight that they've deserved for the last 100 or so years.
That's Taylor Bruck, Ulster County Clerk, the Ulster County Clerk's Office, and the Ulster County Restorative Justice and Community Empowerment Center are hosting their first quarterly Lunch and Learn program tomorrow with the subject of early baseball and Black history in Ulster County. It's tomorrow at noon, in person or on Zoom. There's more information at ulstercountyny.gov. Taylor, thank you so much for bringing this piece of history to us and to everybody in the community.
Of course, Tim. Thanks for having me.
We'll take a break and we'll be back with more Radio Catskill after this.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Tavern on Main, where modern American cuisine meets classic favorites. Dinner, weekend brunch, craft cocktails, and warm hospitality on Main Street in Jeffersonville. More at tavernonmainny.com.
On the next Radiolab.
What the left used to tell you is, look, you're just born this way.
Of course we are born that way.
We didn't just wake up one day and decide to be gay.
None of this has anything to do with culture.
It was something we were born with.
None of this has anything to do with nurture.
A new study found there is no single gene that
born this way
that can determine a person's sexual orientation.
Myth.
Born this way? That's on the next Radiolab.
Today at 2 on Radio Catskill.
This Week in This American Life. When Jennifer was 3, she lived in an all-black neighborhood in Milwaukee. One day she was riding her tricycle and saw an older white couple sitting on a bench.
Because I had never seen white people, I assumed that they were ghosts. So I waved, and I remember hearing, I thought, wow, that must be the way they talk.
Kid Logic, true stories, this week on This American Life.
Saturday night at 6 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Now, updates to a couple of New York State stories from the New York Public News Network. Leon Botstein has formally addressed the Bard community after the college president's name surfaced in the Epstein files. From the New York Public News Network, WAMC's Elias Guerra reports.
Mr. Epstein was not my friend. He was a prospective donor. That's how Bard College president Leon Botstein framed his relationship with the convicted sex offender in a letter to the campus community obtained by WAMC News. Botstein wrote that the first contact between the two men came in 2011 after an unsolicited gift from Epstein of $75,000 to Bard High School Early College. Botstein says he pursued the relationship, quote, in fulfillment of my responsibilities as the chief fundraiser for the college. Botstein, who has been at Bard since 1975, refers to Epstein as, quote, a skilled manipulator, prodigious networker, and serial exaggerator. Regarding a trip to Epstein's Island in 2012, detailed in a tranche of emails released by the U.S. Department of Justice, Botstein said he went solely to attend a fundraising dinner with billionaire investor Leon Black. Botstein wrote, quote, Mr. Epstein was present for dinner. I became ill, stayed by myself, and took a commercial flight home. I thanked Mr. Epstein for facilitating the engagement with the Blacks. Botstein also told the Bard community he was not aware of the full extent of Epstein's alleged crimes until Epstein's arrest, writing, quote, I was not following the revelatory closing chapter of Mr. Epstein's life and the extent of his crimes until he was arrested in 2019. Botstein ended the letter saying, I want to express my regret at this connection and my deepest sympathy these for Epstein's victims. Sincerely, Leon Botstein. For the New York Public News Network, I'm Elias Guerra.
And people with disabilities and their advocates are gathering in Albany this week to press state lawmakers on key priorities. Samuel King with the New York Public News Network reports they want progress on pay for workers, expanded access to affordable housing for employees, and providing more access to employment opportunities.
The New York Alliance for Inclusion and Innovation, the ARC New York, and the Developmental Disabilities Alliance of New York are lobbying lawmakers in Albany this week and trying to present a united front. Among their priorities is a 2.7% increase in funding for direct care workers and providers. Governor Kathy Hochul has proposed a 1.7% increase. Michael Seawrighter is president and CEO of the New York Alliance for Inclusion and Innovation.
If we're expected to keep pace with the rate of inflation in our communities around the state, these organizations need those kinds of resources.
Senator Pat Fahey leads the Senate Disabilities Committee. The Albany Democrat says the group's unity is helping them make the case for more resources.
We are trying to move that needle. Yes, it takes tens of millions of dollars, but we think it's important because these are among our lowest wage workers. They also have high turnover, and that doesn't help anyone.
Fahey also supports bills on housing and expanding access to employment for people with disabilities. The House and Senate are expected to come up with their own budget proposals next month. In Albany, I'm Samuel King with the New York Public News Network.
Coming up, Frost Valley rolling out a new way for families to share the camp experience. We'll get the details after this. This is Radio Chatskill.
Hello, Radio Catskill listeners. This is Andy Carlson, and I'm inviting you to join me Thursday nights for 2 hours of genre-bending exploration of the American rock songbook on Ramble Tamble. I'll be bringing you everything from John Prine to PJ Harvey, Steely Dan to Steppenwolf, and just about everything in between. That's Ramble Tamble, Thursday nights at 7, only on
Radio Catskill.
Next time on the Retro Cocktail Hour, we'll hear Henry Mancini from the TV show Mr. Lucky. Also, George Shearing plays Nat King Cole Sings, plus the sound of 50s exotica music. I'm Daryl Brogdon. Join me where the music is shaken, not stirred. The Retro Cocktail Hour.
Coming up tonight at 7 on Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Frost Valley is rolling out a new way for families to share the camp experience. Their Booster Club lets parents refer new campers, celebrate those connections, and earn some special rewards, all without selling anything. That's nice. Joining us live in the studio to explain how it works, plus some other events coming up, is Jen Dresdow, Associate Director of Specialty Camping, and Mary Boyd, who is the Trips and Adventures Director. You guys have the best titles, I have to say. Welcome.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Jen, let's remind folks about Frost Valley and the experiences you guys provide there, why you have these cool titles.
Absolutely. So one of the big pinnacles of Frost Valley is that we say we're for all. So I always like to remind people, we have programs for everyone. We have so much to offer at Frost Valley, from our year-round programs for families on the weekend to our extensive summer camp programs, including Mary's great Trips and Adventure program.
Go ahead, Mary.
Yeah, I will say part of the reason we have such cool job titles is because we really do have a program for everybody, whether you're 9 years old or 99 years old. I get to oversee our adventure and trips programs, where we have campers as young as 10 years old, all the way up to 17 years old, going on trips in upstate New York, and then also across New England, even to Canada and to West Virginia. So we run trips for folks who are really looking to get outside, or if they've already spent a lot of time backpacking or adventuring, to be able to refine those skills.
You guys at the Frost Valley, you kind of talk about camp magic. Talk about that. What does that mean for folks and for kids spending, you know, a session there?
Yeah, I always tell parents that the camper you drop off at camp is not the camper that you pick up, whether it's a week-long or a five-week-long session. Campers, when you pick them up, they're braver. They're more deeply connected to their friends, to nature. And Frost Valley has over 100 summers under its belt and has so many core traditions and values and things that really make it stand out versus any other camp that I've ever visited.
What kinds of growth do you see in campers from beginning to end? When you drop them off, they're not the same.
I think we see so much growth in their personal development and how they operate independently. So you'll see campers come home and parents will reach out to us and say, oh my gosh, my camper gets up in the morning and makes their bed and picks up their things, and they come down to breakfast and they're so excited to just like say, hey, what are we doing today? And just that building those independent skills and being braver in the world too and willing to try more things.
Tell us more about this Booster Club idea. What are the details of that?
Absolutely. So our Booster Club, we're really rewarding families for doing what they were already doing, right? They were already sharing word of mouth and saying, hey, my kid goes to this great camp. Your kid should too. And now we're just saying, hey, tell us who that is. We'll take the reins from there. We'll do all the legwork. We'll reach out to them. We'll say, hey, we hear you'd be a great fit for Frost Valley. And one of our pieces of having all this great staff is we're able to talk to parents and find which of our programs is the right fit for their camper. So maybe they're a farm camper, maybe they're an adventure camper, maybe they're a horse girl, or maybe, you know, traditional camp is the best fit for them. So we help with that process, and then we're rewarding that camper with a gift certificate to the camp store and a little sticker pack and just some exciting merch. And then it builds as you refer more friends, you get better rewards.
Why do you, we said this at the beginning, it's not about selling things. It's about connection and the relationships. Why is that distinction important, do you think, for the Booster Club?
I would say with
a little more in front. There you go.
I would say it is a really, really powerful way to use word of mouth. Is we can put up advertisements, we can put up social media posts, but ultimately having somebody approach you who's also a parent and say, hey, I know it's scary sending your child away from home, especially for the first time or for more than a week at a time. I trust Frost Valley, and I think your child would be a great fit for this program. And I think it's just really a really awesome way to get more campers connected.
And what was the inspiration behind it? Why launch it now?
The inspiration behind it was, again, our one of our mottos is more things for more people. So really just finding a way to say, yes, we want you to send us your friends. We want more people coming to Frost Valley. We're so excited to share our programs. We're so excited to get kids to camp. Help us help you get more kids to camp, right, together. So it was really just a new way to, again, engage our families, recognize them for doing what they were already doing, say thank you, and get more kids to camp to have this wonderful experience.
I'm excited that we're talking about camp. That means it's going to be warm soon. I'm just kind of picturing it when it's like snowy and, you know, 28 outside. Talk a little bit about some of the other events that you have coming up. You mentioned there's a community event coming up soon. And then, Mary, I want to hear more about these adventures and trips.
Absolutely. So this Saturday on Valentine's Day at our East Valley Ranch property, so we have our main camp on Frost Valley Road. This event is over at East Valley Ranch, which is off of Denning Road. You can RSVP for it on our website. It's this Saturday from 1 to 3. It's going to just be a great free community event where families can come in with their kids. We'll have great treats. We'll have some raffles. We're going to do crafts, make some Valentines, and just celebrate the holiday and have some great time together and share, you know, some treats and different things. So it'll be a great time.
And Mary, you're already planning your adventures and trips for the year. What do you got coming up?
We have some really exciting trips coming up for campers rising 7th grade through the 12th grade, especially for high school students. We have a local Catskills Trail Builder trip, which is 2 weeks, and teens can get up to 30 hours of community service hours required for high school, which is awesome. And it also, with that service learning piece, has a lot of experiential learning, backpacking, climbing, those kinds of fun elements as well. We also have a 3-week, 100-mile trip up at the northern terminus of the Appalachian Trail in Maine, culminating in a Katahdin summit.
More details on the 100 miles. Are you walking the 100 miles?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, backpacking. We offer a lot of different section hikes of the AT, and the northern terminus is a really, really special one. So we're excited for that. And we also have a 5-week 46er trip where campers, high school students are trying to bag as many peaks as they can over the course of five weeks.
That's so cool. I didn't realize that there were so many kids that may be involved at that age in those lengths of trips. But I guess that is part of what you're doing here and encouraging that exploration. And talk a little bit about how, you know, this time outdoors, this time camping, this time on these trips, how that just really helps kids in this day and age, especially when they're probably could be glued to a screen somewhere instead.
Yeah, there's a lot of literature out there about that, but a lot of what we've seen at the Y is that overnight camp is one of our most impactful programs that we run. And backcountry settings are just a catalyst toward all the positive youth outcomes that we're looking for. Jen mentioned independence, making friends, becoming stewards, being accountable. Those things happen a lot faster when you're out in a camping setting and you're unplugged from your screens. Your brain actually, like after 3 days without your phone, your neurobiology actually changes after not having that. And being able to amplify that over 3 or 5 weeks, it really is there's no experience like that for kids nowadays.
Talk about it, some of the other experiences in camping. I know last year I had some friends and their kids went to your camps, and one of them was like, like a Harry Potter themed camp. And you know, that sounds really cool, and it is, and they talked about how great it was, but there's this science behind it. There's this reasoning behind it. Talk a little bit more about how you plan those kinds of things for kids to tap into, you know, that magical side of things, but also the realities of what you're talking about, Mary.
Yeah, my programming philosophy when I'm thinking about like what activities are we going to do this summer, I like to imagine what can campers do in the real world. Like, can we go like raid the camp store and there's candy out and waiting for us? Or can we do rock throwing somewhere where we're not going to break any glass windows, or things that campers just aren't able to do at school or at home or in any of their extracurriculars? And so you mentioned like Harry Potter, tapping into that fantasy side and being able to give campers a space to be creative in ways that they may not be able to, and looking at how we can leverage unstructured programming and having more choice and autonomy in that is really something that we really value.
Yeah. Jen, tell us folks about where they can get more information about the camp programs, the trips programs, the booster club, and the event on Saturday.
Absolutely. So our website is frostvalley.org. And for camps, just click on the link that says camps. It'll take you to all of our different programs. And again, you can view virtual tours, You're also welcome to call us anytime and speak to any of our camp directors. We'd love to chat and help you pick the right program for your camper. And again, on frostvalley.org, if you click on Families and Alumni, it'll take you to a link where you can find our calendar and see all of our wonderful upcoming community programs that we have.
You know, before we go, I have to ask about the titles again. They're so cool. Did you think that you would be like the director of adventures and trips? I mean, people like want to be a doctor or, you know, a police officer, but director of adventures and trips, really cool.
Once I started working at Y, I knew that any job that had adventure and director in the same title was my dream job. 100%.
And Jen, like director of camping, also cool.
Yeah. So I actually started in Mary's position when I started at Frost Valley and then brought her in to replace me as I moved into this associate director of specialty camping. But I'm always like, how cool is it? Like specialty camping is, it's our horse camp, it's our farm camp, it's our trips and adventure. Like it's the best things, yeah. Right? Like I love my job.
And you guys are doing great things for kids all around. Thank you guys so much. That's Jen Dresdow, Associate Director of Specialty Camping, and Mary Boyd, Director of Adventures and Trips at Frost Valley. There's more information at frostvalley.org. Thank you so much. Have a great camping and adventure season.
Thank you.
We'll take a break. And when we come back, an interesting development when it comes to one of our fan favorite singers. Fans lined up for hours in the cold to shop Cyndi Lauper's closet in New York City. Now, some of those pieces are available upstate. Yes, Mary's mouth is wide open. Yes, and this sale is going to help fight hunger. We're going to get the details next. This is Radio Chatskill.
Support comes from Sullivan Allies Leading Together. Committed to ensuring the safety of our community. Protect those most important by keeping medications in a secure space. Be a part of the solution. More at saltcares.com.
So here's the deal. Public radio is now operating without federal funding, and your support matters more than ever. One way to help is to donate that car, truck, or old motorcycle in your driveway. You'll clear out some space and help keep trusted news coverage alive in your community. The process? Simple, free, even tax deductible. Just head to this station's website and help us keep this work going together.
Donate your car, boat, or motorcycle at wjffradio.org.
I'm Maria Hinojosa, this week on Latino USA. We bring you a taste of the newest season of the Futuro Studios hit show, La Brega.
You couldn't, in good faith, stand back and look up at that pedestal and say, Juan Ponce de Leones, standing tall and proud and straight, you know?
That's this week on Latino USA. Thursday afternoon at 2 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. And that is, of course, the memorable opening of Cyndi Lauper's Girls Just Want to Have Fun. Legendary pop icon Cyndi Lauper recently opened up her closet in New York City for a two-day sale featuring more than 20 years of stage costumes, vintage pieces, and designer fashion. Fans waited for hours in the cold to get their hands on this piece of music history. The event sold out, but not entirely. Some of those one-of-a-kind items have now made their way upstate. This Friday and Saturday, the Stickit Inn in Berryville is hosting a Cyndi Lauper closet clearance sale, with part of the proceeds going to the St. Anthony's Food Pantry in Yulin. Joining us now is Johnny Pizzolatto of the Stickit Inn. Johnny, welcome.
Good morning. How's it going, Tim?
It's going great. I have to ask, how did you get your hands on Cyndi Lauper's closet?
Well, it's a really fun story. So I've been friends with her stylist for over 20 years, and she was telling me about the sale as Cindy's retiring, that they were going to do some charitable work and sell some things in New York. And I said, I wish we could do that upstate. And she said, you know what? I'll save some things and we'll do a little version of it upstate. So we have a lot of the more streetwear, you know, things you can buy from stores. But then she did save a couple of like key costume pieces as well. So it should be a pretty exciting selection.
She must have had to have hidden those pieces, because this was a big event. Fans waited outside for hours, as I mentioned. It was sold out. Were you helping involved in selecting any of the pieces, or is she bringing you some special things that she set aside?
Yeah, no, she's bringing special things she set aside. She's been all things, you know, Cyndi Lauper for the past 25 years. So, you know, I let her do her job and was just excited to be included.
So you've seen some of the stuff that's coming up. What stands out to you personally? Is there one piece that's kind of, wow, this is a real Cindy piece?
Yeah, there's a coat. I think it's an Alexander McQueen coat that she wore, that she's been photographed in a couple times. It's really, really beautiful that I know she saved for the sale upstate. And then there's just a lot of like fun things. You know, we'll try to pull some pictures together so people can see Cindy in the wares as well. But yeah, I think people will be really excited to see, you know, what a legend wears.
Are you bracing for a similar big turnout of fans and folks showing up this weekend?
I mean, if the show at Bethel Woods is any indication, she's got a lot of fans
she
up
does.
Here. So, yeah, hopefully people come out for it. But, yeah, it was a great show this summer, and I think people were excited to have her in the area. So maybe they'll want a piece of her closet as well. Who knows?
How are you letting folks know about the history of each item? Is the stylist, wardrobe designer coming up, or are you getting briefed? How you let folks know what's what?
Yeah, she'll be on hand the whole time during the sale, so you'll be able to talk to her about, you know, where Cindy wore things and how best to wear it. So, yeah, you get a little piece of fashion advice and a piece of nostalgia, so it should be a great day.
And it's not just a fashion event, as I mentioned, also a fundraiser. Talk about why it's important to benefit St. Anthony's Food Pantry.
Well, the St. Anthony's Food Pantry is near and dear to my heart. We feed about 37 families right now. I've been a volunteer there for the past 5 years, and it's headed off by a good friend of mine, Margie Granisi. And I couldn't think of a better place to put it, because it's where you can see your help locally and your efforts locally. And, you know, her stylist asked where we'd like the funds to go, and that's the first thing that came to mind, because it's something near and dear to my heart.
Yeah, and that in that sale in January last month was also a benefit. Net proceeds went to the Girls Just Want to Have Fundamental Rights Fund, which is Cindy's passion there too. So it's nice that you're continuing that spirit of philanthropy. How are you transforming the inn into this pop-up fashion archive?
Well, we have 4 rolling racks coming in, and the furniture's out. So it'll be a standing room, hopefully people shopping and drinking cider event.
Okay, so for listeners thinking about stopping by, what do they need to know? I mentioned it's Friday and Saturday. Friday's like a preview, right?
Yeah, Friday is 5 to 10, and it's part of the Pussycat Lounge, which is a event that happens monthly, thrown by the girls from the Basic Bitches Band. Saturday is all day, so you can grab a coffee first thing in the morning. It starts at 8 o'clock and goes until 2 p.m. So it should be a great day. You can either come at night, have a cider, or come by in the morning and drink a coffee with us and do some shopping.
And you're, you know, been a fixture in Berryville for many years now. Beyond this celebrity connection and the benefit for the St. Anthony's Food Pantry, what do you hope it brings to the community this weekend, this event?
Just some fun. You know, it's like the middle of winter. It's been a cold one and a snowy one. So I hope people just have fun with it and, you know, get to experience a little bit of nostalgia right here in our backyard.
That's Johnny Pizzolatto of the Stick It Inn. They're hosting a Cyndi Lauper closet clearance sale. You can pick up some iconic fashions from that iconic pop star this weekend, with the part of the proceeds going to the St. Anthony's Food Pantry in Yulin. There's more information at stickitin.com. Thank you so much for sharing this with us, and have a great time.
Yeah, thanks, Tim. I hope you can make it down.
All right. We'll take a break, and when we come back, inspired by Woody Guthrie and Pete Seeger, Richard Holler has spent 30 years creating theater inside prisons and New York stages. He's now channeling that experience into a new show, Songs of Love and Outrage. He joins us live next. This is Radio Chatskill.
Hi, Ira Flatow here from Science Friday. We view Sci-Fry as a refreshing break from the daily bombardment of political news. You know, there's lots of important and interesting science and technology out there. Whether it's the deep, dark mysteries of the universe or your deep, dark microbiome, it's all right here. So start your weekends with thought-provoking news on Radio Catskill.
Next time on City Arts and Lectures, writer Jhumpa Lahiri. She's the author of Interpreter of Maladies and The Namesake. Lahiri now lives mostly in Italy. And for her latest book, Whereabouts, she first wrote the story in Italian before translating it into English. That's next time on City Arts and Lectures on this public radio station.
City Arts and Lectures, Sunday afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill. Support comes from Catskill Art Space in Livingston Manor, offering exhibitions, performances, screenings, and more, with long-term installations from James Turrell and Saul LeWitt. Open year-round. CatskillArtSpace.org.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On Saturday, singer-songwriter and playwright Richard Holler brings songs of love and outrage to the stage. It's an evening inspired by the protest traditions of Woody Guthrie, Phil Ochs, and Pete Seeger. For more than three decades, Holler has created theater with at-risk youth and incarcerated New Yorkers, founded a professional acting company for the formerly incarcerated, and recently published a book about his work inside prison walls. Now he's turning his lens inward and outward through music. Richard Holler joins us live now. Good morning.
Good morning.
The show, Songs of Love and Outrage, a powerful pairing of words there. What does that combination mean to you right now in this moment?
Well, I mean, it's funny. I had a friend who used to sign her emails, you know, peace and outrage. And I always found that very interesting, you know, and I just sort of did a little twist on that. Yeah, I mean, it seems like it's, you know, the thing that nobody wants to talk about is love ever. You know what I mean? It's ironic that they're doing this on Valentine's Day. But I think that is one of the most kind of proper responses to the outrage sometimes, you know what I mean? Rather than just feeding the fire, trying to sort of quell that a little bit with just thinking in the other direction of how do we connect with each other? How do we talk to each other? How do we not, you know, keep stoking this furnace of outrage that's going on?
You invoke Guthrie, Ochs and Seeger, as we mentioned, artists who weren't afraid to challenge power. What do you think protest music looks and sounds like now in 2026?
Yeah, it's interesting because a lot of people have been telling me that we're kind of moving back to the 60s, you know, in the types of music that folk music is having a resurgence. These are, you know, men that really influenced me when I was young and still do, singer-songwriters, because they were able to get a message across without alienating the audience. You know, there's something about music that no matter what words you're using, the music somehow gains access to our hearts, and we can sort of take a tough message sometimes without getting defensive or closing off. And I think that's where I'm hoping that music is going nowadays, because it's one of the ways that we can sort of deal with just a lot of the huge sort of changes that have occurred that seem to be, I don't know, they just seem to be kind of eating away at the fabric of our society.
I mentioned that you spent decades working with at-risk youth, incarcerated New Yorkers, formerly incarcerated through a professional acting company. Talk a little bit more about that experience and tell us how that's shaped the songs that you're writing today.
Yeah, I've started working, I've always taught, you know, throughout my whole career as sometimes because, you know, I teach because to make a living, but most of the time I would teach. There were times when I taught where I wasn't getting paid because I just enjoy teaching. And I found that in the field that I work in theater, that working with at-risk kids, working with difficult populations, let's say, that have had difficult lives, that it is a real outlet for them. And it often transforms what is negative behavior in their lives into positive behavior on stage. And so I found it a very rewarding place to work. And when I started 15 years ago, I started working at Otisville State Prison. I was invited up to do a one-off class, just a master class. And the men were so hungry for the work and so into it that I 15 years later, I was still there. And we mounted like 8 productions during my tenure there. And it was often I would bring my guitar in because there's such a dearth of arts, you know, in prisons. It's just so hard to find it. And I would bring in my guitar and I would sing songs. And like after we would do a show or, you know, just sort of as a kind of a special treat. And a couple years ago, one of the men says, you know, Rich, you always sing these cover songs. He says, why don't you sing some of your own songs? And I was like, well, you know, I wrote one song when I was 19 and, you know, I really haven't written anything. I write straight fiction and essay and memoir and stuff like that. And this guy says to me, he says, well, you know, Rich, you know what you do when you sing covers? And I says, what? He goes, you're covering. And I thought, oh, gosh. Because, you know, in an acting class, I'm constantly asking them to open up, to show us who they really are, to not, you know, to drop the defenses. And here this message is coming back at me, you know. And I thought, wow, okay, there's a challenge. And there was a parole summit coming up, which is a annual meeting where they discuss how they can possibly improve the parole situation, especially for a lot of older men who have been there for decades, and, you know, how they can somehow have them released before they're too sick to have any kind of life left afterward. And they asked me to speak, and I wrote three more speeches. None of them seemed right. And I said, well, maybe now's the time. Maybe it's a song. And I wrote this song called Give Me One More Chance, and that opened a portal that had been closed for a long time, and I've been just writing constantly since then. I've been performing my songs around, and of course, I brought them back into the prison, and they were, my first audience was the men inside, and they've been so supportive. And I recently did a concert at HB Studio, and like 8 of the men showed up that were out, and they sat in the front row. And I can't tell you, I just felt the love that I felt was unbelievable. I think that's another thing where the love comes from in the title.
Yeah. I mean, we often hear about how artistic outreach and programs like this help those who are incarcerated, which I know it certainly has and does. But what we may not hear about is how it changes you and your role. You mentioned that these men said you should write. Was that the moment that changed the way you see your role as an artist?
Well, it was a moment where, you know, when you're teaching a lot, you know, you tend to, advise and coax and try to get everybody to work to their greatest potential. And sometimes you kind of forget that applies to you also, you know, as an artist. And that was, it was a great reminder that it was time for me to open up more, that I'm not done, you know, and that there are other ways that I can express myself. And I've always loved music and I've always sang. And this I've considered this a real gift, and that is a great insight, because, you know, people think of you going to the prison and you're giving and you're giving and you're giving, but they don't realize what you're getting, you know. And I got an enormous amount of encouragement and just permission from the men I worked with all those years to go ahead and pursue what it is that I really wanted, you know.
Does pursuing this work for you also help dispel some of the myths that some folks may put around folks who are incarcerated or even locations? I mean, you conducted workshops on Rikers Island for more than a decade.
Right.
You know, do you feel that in some ways you're helping spread a little bit more understanding about what these men are going through as well through your art?
I hope so. I hope so, because I feel that a lot of the representations of prison and prison life on, you know, in the regular film and movies and stuff, there are a lot of cliches and a lot of the same old, and you don't really, I have witnessed firsthand, you know, what it's really like. Yeah, I mean, I don't know what it's like for them. I mean, I'm not going to say I know how they feel, but I have witnessed the conditions, and I have witnessed the incredible ability of a human being to rise above it and to reach out and to try to, you know, get their life. They're really putting their lives back together. And this is something that you don't hear about or see about, you know, that there's a lot of work going on in prison to not so much correct, but to get back to a life that they never had in a weird sort of way, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. We mentioned that the concert is coming up on Saturday, Valentine's Day. Not intentional, but your right. Show does include love alongside outrage in the title there. Did the songs feel more personal or more political, or is that a false distinction?
I When I first, I recently did a concert for the Fortune Society here in New York City in Harlem, and I was going to do all protest songs because there were a lot of people from WBAI coming, and I said, okay, I'm going to do all this, the kind of stuff that's going to charge everybody up. And then I spoke with David Rothenberg, who is the founder of the Fortune Society, and he said, sing what you want to sing. And so that's where it came up with this mix of songs. I start out with songs about family. There's so much in my work that I've done over the years. You know, family is just so central to everything. So I talk about my family and then I move into these love songs, some which are wry and some which are sad. And then it sort of gradually goes into a couple of songs from the prison and then the social justice or social awareness music. So it really is, it comes from a very, you know, personal place and then moves out into kind of a mature view and then into, I don't want to say political, you know what I mean? I do want to say community oriented, society oriented. I don't necessarily want to say that it's, you know, I don't want to be divisive, you know, mm-hmm. I just want to put out there what I see, what I feel, and what I've experienced, and hopefully, you know, hoping that folks will resonate with that.
And, you know, maybe give folks a way to express their own outrage and love at the same time.
Yes.
Saturday at 2 at Krauss Recital Hall there in Narrowsburg is when this is happening. It's a part of the Delaware Valley Arts Alliance's Salon Series, and there's more information at DelawareValleyArtsAlliance.org. Before we go, though, Richard, I do want to ask you about your book. You just published Acting Out, How a Prison Theater Workshop Broke Free. That's out from Bloomsbury last month. Give folks a little bit a taste of what's in the book.
Yeah, the book is pretty straightforwardly a chronicle of the first time I drove up to the prison 15 years ago. You know, drove up to the gates for the first time and what I thought was going to be a one-time thing. And then just through the years, you know, just all the workshops that I've taught, the shows that I've done. When the prison shut down during COVID, you know, I had already started the outside company. And so then I focused, you know, on online shows, which was a nightmare. But then we got back to, you know, we got back to regular productions again on the outside and the inside. And so, and it really is, you know, like it's a kind of book where you change all the names to protect it, you know, folks and stuff, but it really is about people, and it's about people's lives and their stories. And so each chapter, you know, you just meet some incredible human beings and in the most unlikely place and hear stories that are inspiring and sometimes terrifying. You know, I didn't sort of try to skew it in any direction. I just reported what I saw, and it just progresses. I've been told that it's a really fast read, that people want to keep reading it, which makes me feel really good. And when I was working on it, I mean, I had to read it. Oh my gosh, I can't tell you how many times I had to read it as I was working with the editor, you know, and I never really got tired of it because it felt really good to put this down. And as you brought up before, to be able to, if anybody wants to know what it's really like, you know, in a prison environment, I think this book speaks to that in a very, very honest way.
That's Richard Holler. Songs of Love and Outrage is his show coming up at the Delaware Valley Arts Alliance on Saturday at 2. And you can learn more about Richard's extensive work, not just books, but theater, television, songs, at richardholler.com. It's H-O-E-H-L-E-R. Richard, thank you so much.
Sure. Thank you.
That's going to do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. A reminder, you can find this show and all of our shows that we produce locally at our website, wjffradio.org. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support comes from Garnet Health Medical Center, Catskills, with campuses in Harris and Calicoon, offering inpatient and outpatient services to Sullivan County and surrounding communities. Learn more at garnethealth.org.
Hey, it's Francis Lam, host of The Splendid Table, This week, we have food and feelings with Jarell Guy's new cookbook that helps us take care of ourselves when we need a boost. Also, food writer Bea Wilson sheds light on the emotional lives of kitchen tools. It's coming up on The Splendid Table.
The Splendid Table, Sunday morning at 11 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. We're going to see some snow showers this afternoon and into the evening. Little to no accumulation, though, according to the National Weather Service. Today's high 33, breezy tonight, a low of 19. Tomorrow, a little cooler, 27 for the high and still breezy. The low tomorrow night, 11. Looking ahead, Friday, partly sunny and 30 for the weekend, 34 on Saturday and Sunday, 40 degrees. What? But some snow possible in the evening.
WJFF Jeffersonville. From river to river, mountain to mountain, we are Radio Catskill.